Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Steve Zell is the author of Urban Limit, a thriller about an Oregon family that fights for survival in the snowy mountains. This book follows his horror novels Wizard and Running Cold. Kirkus's reviewer called Urban Limit an unnerving but memorable tale. In this sponsored interview, we talk with Steve about his latest novel. Steve, welcome to Fully Booked.
Thank you.
You were an animator and a session vocalist. How did you get interested in writing novels?
I've always kind of done all of them. I've always liked to sing. I've always liked to do art. And I've always liked to write. The neat thing about it is I've been able to jump back and forth between them. So if I get a little bit tired of doing one thing, I kind of jump into the other. And it all kind of gives me a little bit more energy.
What inspired you to feature teenage twins in Urban Limit?
I think we all have several personalities. And I think it was interesting to me to have two completely different people that both had talents and both had a lot of things in common, but went in completely different ways. And having them as fraternal twins, so we've got a male and female, but really very much the same and very much different, kind of keyed that in an easy way for me to look at it. So we have one twin that basically spends all of his life pretty much online in a game that's a little bit like World of Warcraft, I guess that'd probably be closest to it. And then we have the female who is very much outgoing. She's an Olympian, at least an Olympian hopeful. And it was just interesting to see somebody with a, you know, really the same sort of roots going in two different directions.
Are you planning a sequel to Urban Limit?
Oh, yes, I am. Yeah, the seeds of it are there. And I've, you know, I write little pieces of it. I tend to write three or four stories at the same time. And then whichever one kind of picks up at a certain point, I kind of run with that. So right now it's in there. It's kind of on the way, but I've got another one coming out before that.
Oh, and then what's that one?
Well, I can't say too much about it, except that it's essentially, it goes back to Running Cold and takes two of the characters from that and puts them onto a parallel sort of a story. It's not really a sequel to Running Cold, but it's in that same world. Urban Limit, that sequel is very, very different.
In addition to writing, you participate in community theater and love to visit ghost town. How does this help you create your stories?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's great about community theater and just theater in general, and I think from a writing standpoint, is you really get a feel for the sort of things people say and wouldn't say if you come across dialogue on stage that just doesn't come out right. It's pretty obvious. And I think it helps in one thing in as far as dialogue goes. And in general, I think anytime you've got a few different sort of creative things going on, and ghost towns in general too, just because, you know, there's some sort of supernatural force you feel there. I think all those things just kind of play into it.
Well, Steve, thanks for talking to us about your latest novel. If you're just joining the podcast, you can order Steve Zell's Urban Limit at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor-in-chief of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm Megan LaBrice. I'm the staff writer.
And this is Fully Booked, a Kirkus Reviews podcast. Welcome. We're really thrilled today to be talking to Rick Bragg. Maybe, I don't know, our last unfiltered Southern storyteller. Well, we have Roy Blunt Jr.
Yeah, who also writes well about food. And this is a food-centered book. The best cook in the world, Clay.
Yeah, Rick Bragg's book. We're going to leave it to the interview to reveal who exactly the best cook in the world is.
But well, outside of the book, do you have an opinion of who the best cook in the world is?
My mama. Hi, Mom.
I was hoping you'd say that.
But Rick has won a Pulitzer Prize, right? He's published maybe 8 previous books.
Good guess. 8 previous books, including bestseller Ava's Man and All Over But the Shouting.
All Over But the Shouting was really the one that put him on the map. But I mean, it's such a fascinating career because this is a guy who's been writing about his family and, you know, living family, not just his ancestors, but living family for like 3 decades now. And if I told my sister I'd be writing about her for 3 decades, there would be some hell to pay.
Well, the good thing about a family clay, if you're doing it right, is there's always new fodder, right? You've got new members, they marry in, they have kids, so maybe yeah. one day we'll get a...
Sometimes they leave. Start with your maternal grandfather, because the recipes and stories in this book really kind of begin with him, and he was quite a complex character. You know, your fans have been reading about your family for decades now, but could you tell us a little bit about him?
He's one of those people that when he is mentioned at all, he is mentioned with kind of a raising of the eyebrows and a shake of the head. And sometimes in wonder and sometimes in regret. But, you know, he was, I described him once as a furious man. You know, we don't use that word very much anymore. But he was a fighter and he was a logger. And the reason he is so deeply involved in this book is he was a cook for, you know, for those violent, hardworking people. He, you know, he cooked in logging camps and he cooked for chain gangs, and he cooked for work crews of all kind. And, you know, he was a fighter and a hard drinker. And he was apparently also a biter, but we might not ought to get into that.
Maybe we'll save that for the end.
It might be good.
We really catch up with him for the first time in 1924, and he ends up cooking for a specific pair of newlyweds. Who are they?
Well, my grandfather and grandmother were married under false pretenses. I guess that's a redundant word, but it was her deception. Her sisters, wanting to get her out of the house. This was my grandma Ava, because she was peculiar and she was hard to get along with, and. So they created a box supper for this dance, and back in those days, and this would have been before the Depression, you could, you know, fill a box up with, or a sack, or a flour sack, with, you know, fried chicken and pie and, you know, biscuits, and then people would bid on them at a dance, and it was a very progressive era, and if you won... then, you know, you could enjoy the supper and the company of the young lady who, odd as it seemed, always turned out to be a marrying age. And
how about that?
My grandma couldn't cook a lick, but my grandfather believed she could, and he fell in love with her anyway. And then she proceeded to starve him to death. you know, I mean, it was just, some people can't cook or don't cook. She had no interest in it. You know, she saw no value in salt. You know, she would make vegetable soup, which screams out for salt, you know, because of the tomatoes. And she'd make it with no salt. She would make biscuits that rose to about the height of a vanilla wafer. You know, she was just unconcerned. She just, and my grandfather paid for it. And in desperation, after she ran off, all the cooks he tried to bring in to help teach her to cook was to find the one human on the planet who was fierce enough, furious enough, yet talented enough to teach her to cook. And that was his daddy. So he had to go fetch him. You know, he had to go find him because he had been involved in a unfortunate knifing incident and had to go on the lam, which is another one of those words you don't hear much anymore, but I've always heard it.
It's an absolutely incredible story, you know, the idea of going to fetch him from the deepest woods, you know, from deep in the mountains to come and cook and teach his bride how to maneuver her way around the kitchen. I don't know if we've spoken your great-grandfather's name yet.
Oh, his name was Jimmy Jim Bundram. I guess he was so furious they named him twice, but he he was Jim. There's a picture in the book, and even it, as fierce as it is, doesn't do him justice. He has these eyes that just kind of bore right through you, and he's got this bushy mustache that covers his entire mouth, and you know, he never smiled, but you wouldn't have known if he was smiling anyway. I mean, he was shrouded, and he was a fierce man. The great thing about listening to my people tell a story is, you know, to some people it would just be my grandfather taking a ride into the deep woods to get his father to teach his wife to cook. But when my people tell a story, they tell it with, you know, all the violence and the blood and hopefully some laughter, you know, somewhere along the way. But I think it was a pretty dramatic scene when he came riding up with that old man on back of the mule. And, you know, it's a wonder that the young woman and the old man didn't kill each other.
I have just one more question about him before we turn to the best cook in the world from the title of this book. Our listeners at this point may be deceived thinking that it's Jimmy Jim. It's not, but stay tuned, everybody. But the other question I have is, he's a fierce man. He's a rather taciturn man. But when you write dialogue for Jimmy Jim, I really paid attention to it. It really packs a wallop. I took one quote out, and the quote is, "All greens is medicine. Beans will steady a body, but greens will cure one. But tain't no reason it can't taste good, too." And
exactly.
I was just wondering, how did you approach writing dialogue for these, you know, long deceased ancestors of yours? Is it as if they're speaking through you? Do you cull some dialogue from the stories elders tell you about him? How does it work?
What you have to do is listen to the way that your living people talk. And listen to the way your living people talk. And you ask them what was said. And then you say 1,000 times, well, what'd he say then? And of course they cannot remember. Of course they cannot remember word for word exactly what each conversation was from, you know, 1934 or 1937. But what you listen for is you listen for the facts and you listen for the gist and you listen to the language. And you hope that my grandmother, for instance, who I live with pretty much all my young life, I know the way she talked. I know from listening to my aunts and uncles the way that my grandfather talked. You hope that when they are repeating dialogue from their older people, from their ancestors, you hope that it is as close as you're going to get to gleaning the way that they actually spoke. Greens as medicine is something that I've heard my mama say a million times. Asking her where she got that, well, her mama got it from her father-in-law. And that's where those exchanges come from. And yeah, I don't think that most people who write about the working class people of the Deep South understand the rhythm and the cadence of the way that people talk. They didn't grunt their words. You know, they were not extras in To Kill a Mockingbird or incidental characters from a Tennessee Williams play. You know, they spoke in this beautiful mix of kind of proper English and hillbilly dialect. And it was a mix. You know, they said things, "For I am starving to death." Not "I am starving to death," but "for," because I am starving to death. They said things with real, to me, beauty in them. So, yeah, I try to create that dialogue the best that I can. Mm. And with Jim, obviously Jim vanished from this planet before I arrived on it. So you do the best you can with the wealth of color that you have from, you know, listening to your people talk.
You know, this book, The Best Cook in the World, has hit the bestseller list, so congrats on that. And so our listeners may be familiar with what the book is like, but for anyone who isn't, it has these nice chapters where each, almost every chapter has a recipe. And the recipes don't really read like something you'd find in Bon Appetit. So you were a reporter for a long time, but it seems to me like some of your toughest investigative work has to have been with your mother, particularly when it came to getting her to tell you how long it takes to cook certain dishes. So can you talk about that process of getting the cooking details and info from her?
Sure. It about drove me insane. You know, I've said 100 times about my people is, you know, the stories just kind of well up. You know, that the stories never run dry. You know, they are always there. And if you just wait long enough, if you just spend enough time with your people, the stories will well up. And sometimes you wish they wouldn't well up, but they well up. But the recipes, the math was maddening because, you know, I would ask her, I guess the structure of these and the way that I wrote these recipes was the only way that they could be written. A couple of cooks have asked me, you know, seriously, well, you know, what were your test kitchen results? And I just point to myself and say, you know, I'm 6'2", I weigh 230 pounds. I am the test kitchen for these results. But you know, you ask your mom, you sit with her. There are two big leather chairs in her living room in front of the fireplace. And she would sit in the left-hand chair, and I would sit in the right-hand chair with my notebook. And I would say, all right, you know, tell me how you made butter rolls. And she, you know, it would start always with deviations, with going off on tangents. And when I would, you know, interviewing your mom is difficult. Asking a follow-up question with your mom can be difficult because her patience will run out. So when she says, you know, when I say, well, how much flour? And she would say, well, hon, you know, a handful, which I would learn is not the same as a good handful. You know, yeah. A good handful is different from a handful. You know, there's a difference between a dab, a D-A-B, and a daub, a D-A-U-B. A daub is more than a dab. A smidge is more than a speck. Like she would say sometimes, you know, hon, you know, just a speck of black pepper. How much butter would you use? Well, I don't know, enough. I mean, what in the hell is enough? And the most maddening was when I would say, can you just guess at how much, say, sugar? And she would say, well, you know, hon, just some. Oh. Well, what is some? Isn't some kind of open to interpretation? How long do you cook it? Well, till it smells right or till it looks right. How do you know how much liquid to use? And that's where the secret finally came through.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people drown their food with plain old water. She always used just enough liquid to cover and would always cook the liquid to the point where all those great juices, like saying beef short ribs, potatoes and onions, mm-hmm. when all the liquid, all the water was cooked out except that delicious kind of, you know, meat dripping, you know, that had kind of melted into those potatoes and onions. When everything was gone but that, it was ready. And yeah. So it makes sense. It just, you know, I asked her if she could teach me to cook. I asked her if she could teach me how to make a simple biscuit. And she just said, no. Just no.
You've got some nice lines in this book, but two of my favorites, I guess, are you must at some point have been asking her how long to cook something in the oven because you wanted to put the recipe in this book. And she says, how in the world do I know how their oven cooks? I ain't never been in their house, and I don't even know who they are.
She was utterly flabbergasted at the idea that she would be able to articulate, she should be able to articulate how her ovens, which have always been half worn out when she got them. You know, back in the old days, only in the past 20 years, you know, has my mom been cooking on new ovens. And you know, you have to allow for whether or not one of the elements is half burnt out or not. You have to allow for, you know, sometimes they don't heat evenly or regularly. And I told her, I said, well, Mom, there's just kind of this ideal out there, you know, that we kind of have to guess at. And that concept of an ideal oven, you know, she just couldn't fathom it. It would be like I told her that a spaceship had landed in the backyard.
So just for the record, for everybody listening, the subtitle is Tales from My Mama's Table. So Mama is the best cook in the world. What did she say when you proposed that as a title for this endeavor?
She was pretty well dead set against it at first, and she wins most of those arguments. But I am getting to the age where I can, I can use my own mortality as Mama, I ain't even sure how many books I got left in me. Why don't you let me win this one? But it came about because to me and I wrote this whole thing from what I hoped was the mind, not the mindset, but the kind of the joy of eating of a little boy. I hope that joy comes through, and it, although certainly it's more serious than that in a lot of cases, but she's the best cook in the world. She's always been the best cook in the world. I've eaten all over the world. She's the best cook in the world. But when I told her I wanted to do this book, she said, well, what would you even call a book like that? And I said, the best cook in the world. And she said, well, you know, I wasn't even the best cook that lived on our road. your Aunt Edna was a great cook, and you know, your grandma was a great cook, and I told her, well, that might all be well and good, but calling it the third best cook on the Royal Webb Road didn't sing. And and then after I thought about it, it did kind of sing, but I think the beauty and the simplicity of the title, because I think everybody who's sent me a message or walked up to me at a book signing, and we were on the road for a month and a half, and now we're going to be on the road for another month. And I know that every one of those stops, those folks who line up all want to tell me the way that their people did it. Mm. You know, they want to tell me the way their people did it. And sometimes it's just like, my people did it, and sometimes they want to argue about it, and it has not come to blows yet, and I'm glad, because I just imagine I would lose the battle with an octogenarian fighting me over biscuit preparation, you know. So they think they're mamas and daddies and grandmothers and grandfathers, because there are a lot of men involved in these Southern cooks, that they are the best cook in the world, and they want you to know that. And I think I wanted that title to be shared, too, if that makes any sense. And it may not, because I'm a little bit weary. You know, the title needs to be shared, too, just like the recipes are shared. Yes, your people, your mama, your grandmother, maybe she was the best cook in the world, too. And certainly she was, or he was, in a window in time. Mm-hmm. And, I just think my mom still is. Just, you know, believe me, she made cornbread today. You know, she's, for supper tonight, you know, there will be beans boiling. There will be something cooking.
Will they be pinto beans?
Well, they I'm not there, so yeah, they'll probably do it just to spite me. They love to tell me, my mother and my brothers and my sister-in-law love to tell me when we have the things I really love and I'm not there. So yeah, I mean, since I'm not there, it'll probably be pinto beans and ham. It'll probably be mashed potatoes and because we don't believe in just having one good starch. You know, it'll probably be, you know, red cabbage slaw with carrots and just enough mayonnaise to, you know, to add a little bit of zing and, you know, with some black pepper. It's pretty soon it'll be garden food. It'll be, you know, sweet corn. It'll be green fried tomatoes real soon. It'll be, it'll be stewed squash. It'll be green beans. So, yeah, I mean, pinto beans are, I think I call them the banquet bean or something like that. You know, it's our rich folks bean. If you're going to have company, then you need to have pinto beans.
So you've got this, you know, a memorable line in this book that, quote, in a South that no longer seems to remember its heart, our food may be the best part left. Well, certainly, I mean, that gives a strong indication, you know, how you feel about what you call working class mountain food, the food you write about in this book. But it's also kind of sad that you're saying that South that you knew is long gone, right?
The thing I've always tried to have happen or hope to have happen in these books is that you don't give an aw shucks. I don't mind a good aw shucks in my conversational life.
Mm-hmm.
But in the pages of my books, we do a lot of dumb things down here. You know, it seems that in the way we treat each other, in the way that we treat people that are different from us, it seems that we have lost our heart. It seems like, you know, we are more divided than ever sometimes. And I'm not just talking about race, but race and class and many things. And so that's what I meant by that.
Yeah.
And the food, you know, music has never been my area, even though I've certainly taken a stab at a book or two, but food. I mean, look, even a guy that can't play a harmonica can still, you know, eat a sausage and biscuit and appreciate being Southern. And I think that, you know, when I say maybe the best part of us, I was eating lunch today at a place down near Mobile Bay, a place called Saraceno's, and there were white folks and black folks, and there were working class people. There were contractors, and there were ditch diggers, and there were working people of every stripe sitting elbow to elbow with retirees from Wisconsin and people who pulled up in a Land Rover. And they're, you know, they're there for fried chicken and English peas and mashed potatoes and gravy and cornbread muffins. And they're not just getting along. It's an island, that place. It's just a metal prefab building in the middle of this flat countryside down here, not far from the Gulf of Mexico. But, you know, it's an island. And the reason it's an island is the food. It, you know, it pulls everybody together and holds them together for however long lunch lasts. So that's, I guess, is kind of what I meant by that. And also just the fact that for people, and I don't want to beat this drum too hard, it'll make all our ears hurt after a while, but for working people, you know, the best part of the day was that moment you sit down when the work was over with and you wash your hands and, you know, you try to get, you know, the machine grease off, or you try to get the red mud out between your nails, and you sit down and you eat this glorious, simple meal. And it may just be beans and cornbread and taters or fried cabbage. But it might be a sliver of green onion. You know, and some sliced radishes or sliced tomatoes from a garden. Or it, you know, it may just be a skillet of fried potatoes. It's an island, and not a bad island to be on.
I'm curious, because you have made a really successful career out of writing about your family for a few decades now. Are they used to this, or do they ask if there's a statute of limitations? How is that going?
Well, I can tell you that the statute of limitations has definitely run out on some things. Sometimes I'm just hoping it has. For instance, my mother's sisters, two of them are gone. My Aunt Edna is gone, and my Aunt Sue left us a long time ago. My Aunt Edna in particular left me with stories that I could probably write about for another decade because I spent time with her, and she lived an incredible life. My mother gives me a new story every day. My Aunt Juanita, although her health has been poor, has this childish, almost fiendish joy of you know, stories about violence. And, you know, she just loved, almost devilishly, just loved a good story about a altercation.
Well,
and,
I like her.
she named her dog Clem Ritter after a woman who had been shot in an altercation where she stole somebody's husband. And she just always loved and still does, you know, just absurdity. And so they are, I think they probably enjoy the telling of it more than they enjoy seeing it in print, if that makes any sense. Because they got, you know, they, seeing it in print is almost a third hat. You know, it's the joy was sitting there and grinning about it. I hope they're not jaded. They still look forward to every book coming out. I still have kin folks who will not buy one and wait around until I deliver it and, you know, walk up the driveway. You know, with it. I still have a lot of kin folks who thank me with tears in their eyes for, I don't know. You can't really bring somebody back to life, but you can make it seem that way for just a minute, you know, or two. Yeah. So they're not. I don't know if they're used to it, but they're no longer surprised. I think they're still always a little surprised at the numbers of people who kind of see value in those folks. You know, they understand that it would happen in Atlanta. They understand that it would happen in Jackson, or that it would happen in Austin, or that it would happen in, you know, even, you know, in the mountains up in West Virginia. They get that. They understand that it would even happen in New Orleans. But that it would happen in New York, or that it would happen in San Francisco, or it would happen in Seattle, you know, great reading towns, you know. The fact that I think still, or that, you know, it would happen in London, you know, that still tickles them. One of our great, it's kind of like a you know, when you get your grandfather to take his false teeth out so you could look at them. You know, one of the great oddities in our life is my Chinese version of All Over But the Shouting, because you know, the characters, of course, run up and down, but some words do not translate well. You know, so those words are in English, and so the characters go up and down and up and down and up and down, and then all of a sudden, just in English, possum. And then it picks back up. Why that never gets old, I might speak to how much entertainment we have in the foothills of the Appalachians. But I hope that they're not. I hope they never get used to it.
Well, the book is The Best Cook in the World. The version I read is all in English, and it's very entertaining. So thanks for your time today.
No, I can't remember when I've enjoyed sitting on the back porch quite so much. I only had to fight off 3 wasps and 1 suspicious-looking bee, so it's been a good day.
Well, you've got that Jimmy Jim blood in you, so we know you can best them.
Yeah, I am more than a match for a red wasp. I have no compassion for them. But thank y'all. I really did enjoy this. I mean that. Give me a shout back again sometime.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books right here on Fully Booked.
Here at Podcast One, we love hearing from you. We read every tweet and comment you send our way. So don't miss your chance to take our summer listener survey. Just go to podcastone.com and click on the survey banner, or go to podcastone.com/my survey. It only takes a few minutes, and it gives you the opportunity to make a direct impact on your favorite shows. Tell us how you really feel so we can get to know you better. We value your thoughts and participation. So check out the survey at podcastone.com/my survey, or click on the survey banner on podcastone.com.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
You know, the great thing about interviewing him is, you know, even for a writer who is a really good storyteller on a page, that doesn't always mean that that writer is a really good storyteller when you interview them
right
in person. So it's just so charming to see that he can tell those stories with just as much life as he does in the book. That made me happy.
That did make me happy, but I was a little scared. It was a little tense for me, that whole interview, because I was wondering if you were going to bring up what he said about Texans and pinto beans. And it was something along the lines of, Texans add too much spice to their pinto beans, and they're known for their bad beans and big hats.
Yeah, but there are some book critics in Texas who have never worn a cowboy hat. I've barely worn cowboy boots. So.
You look very sharp today. It's a beautiful ensemble.
So from great Southern storytelling to trauma.
Mm.
We've got some trauma drama.
We do have some trauma drama.
The publishing industry. Tell us about what's going on Twitter.
Well, this all went down on Twitter on May 28th on the account of Chen Chen. He is an American poet. And this tweet went viral pretty fast, about 18,000 likes on this. He presented this idea. I'm just going to read you the tweet. Quote, "A very toxic idea I've encountered in writing programs / lit culture at large is that if you're a white writer, you haven't suffered enough to write gritty, real stuff. This is a toxic idea because it assumes that writers of color are primarily or only of value because of our suffering," end quote. He goes on, and there's like a whole thread, quote, "I've heard white writers complain about not having some great trauma to, quote, use, about writers of color getting so much attention because we're writing about, quote, trendy topics. All of this is, of course, messed up." And I paraphrased the end of that quote because we're a family podcast. But I agree.
Yeah, he's right. You do hear writers say, "I need more drama." It's, and really, if any of us look deep inside, I think we have it.
I think somewhere later on the thread, somebody responded, "I'm starting a new writer's retreat for $1,999 a week. Come to my place and I will abuse you."
Yeah.
So that might be the next newest writer's retreat that's available to all of us. But I mean, bravo for broaching this topic and making it a conversation piece. And I want to get his poetry collection.
Yeah, I mean, he's been on the long list for the National Book Award. He's definitely, you know, somebody to be reading, definitely a recognized poet. But, you know, another writer responded to this tweet of Chen Chen saying, "I too have experienced this trauma envy is what I call it." What kind of a messed up world are we in where there's trauma envy? It's just, on the face of it, it's insane. But it's a messy world. We can always count on our senior editors to come in and clear up the world by talking about the new books that they think are excellent and worth your time. So let's call them up and see what they're liking.
But before we do, for anybody else who wants to pick up his poetry collection, it's called When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities.
That's a great title. I don't know if Rick Braxmiller would like it. But, it is a great title.
Andrea Tomei is the author of House of Belonging, the final novel in her Hesse Creek series, which will be published on June 5th. This romantic drama about a successful female chef who meets a handsome horse rancher follows Walland and Seeds of Intention. Kirkus's reviewer called Seeds of Intention an effortlessly romantic read. In this sponsored interview, we talk with Andrea about her new novel. Andrea, welcome to Fully Booked.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
What inspired you to make the heroine of House of Belonging a renowned chef?
You know, she just kind of came about organically. It was, you know, as part of the series. She's a character that was in my first book, Walland, very briefly. And when I was in the middle of the second book, I kept kind of thinking about her. I thought she was very different than both of my first two female leads, I guess, if you will. She was just very strong, a little bit edgier, and I kept thinking about her. So halfway through the second, I knew she was going to be the title character in the third book.
You were a broadcast journalist who covered news and sports. How did you get interested in writing novels?
I took a break after I got married. My husband played baseball, Major League Baseball, for 20-some years, and so we had to travel a lot, so it just didn't work out to continue doing the broadcasting. But I've always loved writing. My mom was a published poet. I just knew once my kids were in school full time, which they are now, that it was just going to be my time to sit down and really kind of scratch this itch, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
You are working on a new 3-book series set in the mm-hmm. Pacific Northwest. What will the series cover?
The series is going to be based around, I really enjoy writing male characters, and so the series is going to be based around 3 brothers who are very different but have very interesting stories each on their own. So I'm excited to explore that, and I'm toying with the idea of writing in some different tenses, and I don't know, we'll see. We're going to see where it goes. It just kind of comes out when I start writing.
Photography is your second love. How does this help you create your stories?
Well, I'm super visual. In fact, Walland, the first book that I wrote, it was sort of a love letter to this place that I'd been a dozen times with my husband over the years in Tennessee and taken so many pictures. And I'm very inspired visually by looking at photography, by listening to music, and it all just pairs naturally for me. All 3 of my covers are photographs that I've taken.
Who are some of your favorite novelists?
Gosh, I like so many different writers. Sue Monk Kidd is one of my favorites. I think Jojo Moyes is amazing. Jeanette Walls is one of my favorite writers. I there's a list too long to name, but I would say those are 3 that I always kind of go back to.
And what attracted you to the romance genre?
I had no clue I was going to be writing a romance, but honestly, I think I write a lot for my friends and people my age, which are mid-40s moms and younger also. I like to have sort of a subplot with different age characters. I've had a love story among people in their 70s and also younger, like YA, which is something I'm thinking about writing. So I don't know. I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of junk in the news, and we could use a happy ending every now and then.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for talking to us about your latest novel. If you're just joining the podcast, you can order Andrea Tomei's House of Belonging and her other books in the Hesse Creek series at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and select independent bookstores.
We've already talked about a few books this episode, and we're going to talk about some more right now. We've got our senior editors on the line. Some of them are on vacation, but we've got Vicki Smith. She is our children's editor. And Laurie Muchnick is our fiction editor. Hey, Vicki, what is really hot in children's books this week?
Well, this week I wanted to talk about The Confidence Code for Girls by Caddy Kay and Claire Shipman. And They did a book called The Confidence Code in 2014 and addressing what they call the confidence gap between men and women. And rightly understanding that confidence gap starts a lot earlier than adulthood, they have made a kid's version, or I should say a girl's version. And it's so much more and better than just a condensation of the book for adults. It's really been very carefully put together with a young audience in mind. It's got a really zippy format with a lot of different features. There are anecdotes and then longer pieces explaining the neurochemistry behind negative thinking and exercises for kids to do. And what I think is really impressive about it is that they don't dumb down the content for a child audience. You know, they talk about neuroplasticity, and then they explain what they mean, what that means, and give some examples of it. And then the situations that they ask kids to imagine putting these new skills into action in are incredibly relevant to kids. So they talk about neuroplasticity and sort of retraining your brain so that you don't get stuck in negative thought spirals. And the example that they use for helping girls sort of get out of this rut is a sleepover, which is an incredibly stressful event, and also one that is completely familiar to an audience of preteens and early teens. So, you know, self-help books, I'm not always really crazy about, but I found this one so thoughtfully put together. It's just way ahead of most of the rest that I encounter. And as a former girl, there's plenty in here for me too.
I thought it was so interesting, Vicki, that you thought this book was really good compared to the original book for adults. I was looking back at our review of the Confidence Code just for adults. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we said, I mean, it was a very good review, but it says that women, we hold back for fear of seeming pushy and aggressive. And when I read that, I thought, well, women hold back because there have actually been all these studies showing that women are penalized for being what men see as pushy and aggressive. So I think it's great that we're now aiming at girls and maybe bringing up a new generation of girls to be assertive. Maybe by the time they get to be adults, the boys will be used to it and society will change.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point. And it's a very savvy book. It talks a lot about how the media undermines girls' confidence and, you know, looks at, you know, any number of anti-feminist messages that girls are getting and works really hard at overturning them. So yeah, I hadn't thought of that, Lori, that this is also a way to train boys to be more equitable. So, love it.
Turning now to fiction, Lori, what's your choice for us?
I would like to recommend The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner.
Right.
You might remember her from her last book, The Flamethrowers, which came out about 5 years ago, and her first book, The Strange Case of Rachel Kay, which came out in 2015. Both of those were finalists for the National Book Awards, so they were very highly acclaimed and contributed a lot to the cultural conversation at the time. They kind of shot Kushner to the top current pantheon of writers that are interesting and interesting to write about and think about. This book is about a woman called Romy Hall who is in jail for 2 life sentences plus 6 years. I'm not sure what that's about. But Romy grew up in a San Francisco that is so far away from the San Francisco that the tourists see. It's a place where, you know, kids who are 12 years old are dealing drugs and are abandoned by their parents and all kinds of terrible things are happening. So this is her upbringing. Her mother leaves her alone while she goes off with boyfriends, things like that. Then she grows up and is a stripper at the Mars Room, which is the title of the book. And it's the seediest stripping club in San Francisco. So it's not even like a nice stripping club. And she ends up murdering someone who was stalking her. And she just gets caught up in this horrible system with the most negligent public defender who doesn't even manage to get the fact that she'd been being stalked into the trial. So Kushner is really interested. She reminds me of Don DeLillo. She is very interested in systems, how Romy gets caught in this terrible system, and then she goes into prison. And I've never seen Orange is the New Black, the TV show, but I have read the book, and there's a very similar nitty-gritty look at what it's like in prison, what the systems are like, how people deal with each other. And it's just, you know, I wouldn't say it's entertaining. It's horrifying in a lot of ways, but it's fascinating and it feels like an important book at this moment.
Wow.
Yeah, Lori, I often think about how much of our fiction is about, well, maybe not the 1%, but certainly not the so many people who are poor and working crappy jobs that they have to have 2 of in order to support their family at even barely getting by. And it just bugs me that those people are so often forgotten. I'm not sure how I feel about the fact that they're remembered in a movie, in a film, sorry, not a film movie, a book that's about prison. But would you say that this really makes them individuals, you know, people who have agency within their limits, you know, characters who have, I guess, for lack of a better word, real dignity. Because I feel like that's what's often forgotten.
Kushner is very systems oriented, and sometimes it does feel like her characters are pieces in her big idea, but they do have individuality, and you get to really understand the predicament that they're in, if not perhaps their psychology.
All righty. Well, thank you, everybody. So next week is our fun issue episode. We're going to be talking about summer reading, and we're going to interview Jessica Knoll, who had one of the best-selling books, and certainly the best-selling debut novel of 2015, which was The Luckiest Girl Alive, a thriller. And she has a brand new one called The Favorite Sister, and we're going to be asking her all about it. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
The Lady Gang Podcast is giving away something big.
It's happening.
It's happening. Don't worry, I'm sure you're overwhelmed.
Like, really big.
Over $100,000.
Oh, it's over $100,000. Damn. We're like baby Oprahs over here.
Find out just what they're giving away by downloading the Lady Gang Podcast at Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. Also, remember to rate and review.